Hello and welcome to 10x9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn, and this is the 10x9 podcast. This podcast is landing on Easter Sunday, so if you're listening today, have a lovely Easter. And if you're listening at another time, well, I hope you have a lovely day, whatever day that might be. There are 3 stories in this podcast for you, all told in the Black Box in Belfast on March 27th. And the theme was March. And believe it or not, there's not a 12th of July story to be heard.
As a young Catholic boy, it made an impression on me such that I ended up making my first Holy Communion twice.
I resolved to push past my insecurities and give dating a proper go. Inevitably, and sadly for this romantic soul, that meant the apps.
There was a suggestion put forward that we would all throw £10 into a kitty. Whoever's on duty when Mammy passes away will win the money. I thought it was a great idea.
So our 3 stories all feature very specific rites of passage. And our first comes from Cork's finest. Here's Richard O'Leary.
Every year, when March comes around, I'm reminded of my first Holy Communion. As a young Catholic boy, it made an impression on me such that I ended up making my first Holy Communion twice. So this is the story of my 2 first Holy Communions. Long, long ago, in 1971, when I was 6 years old, growing up in Cork, I made my first Holy Communion. And for the occasion, my mother presented me with a souvenir prayer book for the Mass, this prayer book. And on the cover, there's a picture of a little boy dressed in a smart suit with his palms pressed together, looking angelic. And I was like that once, angelic. And you don't believe me, so would you like to see my first Holy Communion photograph?
Yes.
Oh. See, I told you I was angelic once. You can see me with my first communion medal pinned on the lapel of my suit, and I'm wearing a dicky bow, and dicky bows were all the fashion for boys making the first communion that year, which was a torment for me. Being named Richard and sometimes called Dicky, which I hated. In the weeks leading up to our first communion, we had to be taught how to do communion. And it'd be new to us, receiving the sacred host of the Holy Communion from the hand of the priest on the tip of your tongue. How are we to practice? We practice with sweets. A particular brand of mints called silver mints. And I close my eyes and I'd stick out my tongue. And the teacher would place the mint on my tongue. And that's why I'm still partial to silver mints. The other thing I remember about First Holy Communion is the money. Now, I know there are people who say the First Communion is all about the money, which isn't true. But kids were and still are given money by relatives at Holy Communion. And there are people of whom it's said, he still has his First Communion money. Which in my case is actually true. On the day of my First Communion, 1971, I was given plenty of money, including this 10p coin, dated 1971. So that was my first communion, and I never expected to have a second first communion. No one ever does. But me being me, I was destined to do it a second time. It was after I grew up and was in my early 20s, when I was living off the interest from my communion money. And by then, I had become a lapsed Catholic and I no longer went to Mass. And in 1989, I moved north to live in Belfast, as one does. And I met and fell in love with a Protestant from Belfast, as one does. But my Protestant wasn't an ordinary Protestant. My Protestant was a super Protestant. And some of you know what that is. My partner was a Christian, which was a bummer, because I wasn't really into Christians. But one day in March 1989, my partner, Mervyn was Church of Ireland, and he said to me, "Do you want to come this evening to my church?" Which is a bit different from, "Do you want to be part of my gang?" But just as terrifying. Because to be honest, in those days, I'd never before attended a Protestant church, because we didn't have many Protestants in Cork. This happened during Easter week on what I was taught to call Holy Thursday. And Holy Thursday is the anniversary of the first ever Holy Communion conducted by Jesus 2,000 years ago. Except that Mervyn, he didn't call it Holy Thursday. He called it Maundy Thursday. And I vaguely remember hearing it called Maundy Thursday on TV when the Queen handed out some silver coins to the elderly. So, okay, I said, I'll go with you to your church just to see what it's like. And Mervyn attended his local Church of Ireland church in the Shankill area of Belfast on the Fort River estate in Glencairn. And as we drove into the Fort River estate, I tried not to notice all those Union Jack flags, because we didn't have Union Jack flags in Cork. And I feigned indifference to the murals of loyalist paramilitaries. And Mervyn parked his car across from the church facing a concrete wall. And on the concrete wall, there was painted in large capital letters, the three letters K-A-T. K-A-T. And I immediately thought of Kit Kat, my favourite chocolate, and I regularly buy Kit Kat. But I've given up Kit Kat for Lent, so I will not be eating this bar tonight. But I didn't know why the letters K-A-T were printed on the wall of that Protestant housing estate. I mean, what do they mean? So I asked Mervyn, "What does K-A-T mean?" And he turned to me, and he was looking a bit embarrassed, and he said, "It stands for Kill All Tigs." But I had to ask him, "Who are the tigs?" And he replied, "Catholics." By this time, I'm thinking, I shouldn't even be here. And Mervyn did suggest it might be better when we got inside the church if I tried to pass as a Protestant. And he told me when we entered the church, before I stepped into the pew, I should not genuflect. Because Protestants don't genuflect. So we walked into the church and we stepped into the pew and I remembered not to genuflect. Or to bless myself. Because Protestants don't bless themselves either. But I found old habits die hard. I was hoping they wouldn't sing any hymns, because I knew that Protestants like to sing hymns. And I thought there'd be hymns I wouldn't know. So anyway, I glanced around at the church walls. It was a modern church, and it was a bit bare. Like, there were no stations of the cross on the walls. And I thought, this church could do with a few candles. But the Church of Ireland service of Holy Communion was surprisingly similar to the Catholic Mass. I recognised most of the responses, but I tried to tone down my lilting Cork accent. And at the part called the peace, I didn't move. But a woman in the next pew in front of me, she turned around and she held out her hand. And in her half harsh Belfast accent, she said, "Peace be with you." When the Holy Communion was ready to be distributed, the others in the congregation, they slowly walked up to the altar, and I decided to follow them, but to keep an eye on what they were doing. And we formed a line to receive the bread of communion, and I stuck out my tongue. And in the corner of my eye, I could see that the others, they weren't sticking out their tongue. They were holding out the palm of their hand. And that was another thing I learned that day about Protestants. But I came away with a souvenir. No, I didn't steal one of their prayer books, but I did take one of their Protestant service sheets, which has got stenciled on it, St. Andrew's, Glencairn. And 35 years ago have passed since that Holy Thursday night in March in 1969 when I made my second First Communion.
Thank you so much, Richard. What a great start to the evening that was. Brilliant. We're always looking for new storytellers at 10x9, so if you'd like to tell your story and get as polished as Richard, then get in touch at the 10x9 website. Even if it's just a hint of an idea, I'll do my best to help you bring it all together. Okay, on to our next story, and it was only her second time at the 10x9 mic, though she's been a regular for years. Here's the wonderful Kerry Logan with a rather modern approach to a rite of passage.
It was March. "He'd be a lovely guy for you, Keza," Rachel whispered. We'd just been chatting to a friendly guy at a market stall in Ballycastle. Rach knew how much I wanted to meet someone, and how little confidence I had, to the extent that I'd made it to the age of 25 without so much as a first kiss. "He did seem nice," I admitted. "Great, I'll ask him out for you," Rach said, and made a beeline back to his stall. "Would you like to go on a date with my pal Kerry?" Rach asked. "The one with the ginger curls." "Sure," he said, "but I'm working until 4 and then heading back to Belfast." Not to be deterred, Rach arranged for him to meet me outside the market at 4 for a stroll along the beach. I burst out laughing at her boldness. That was our Rach. Always there to give me the boost I needed. Believing in me when I didn't. And sure to leave me in stitches along the way. I came back that afternoon for what was a nice wee date. And while nothing came of it, for me it was an important step. I resolved to push past my insecurities and give dating a proper go. Inevitably, and sadly for this romantic soul, that meant the apps. Tinder, Bumble, Hinge, you name it, I got it. One of my first matches was a French guy called Charlie. On date number 3, we had our first kiss. My first ever. After which he looked at me and said the words every 25-year-old dreams of hearing when they finally cross that threshold. "Have you ever kissed anyone before?" Safe in the knowledge that it could only go up from here, I ploughed on with the apps. You really don't know if you're going to connect with someone until you meet up, so to avoid the time wasters, I soon developed a cut-through-the-crap strategy. I take a quick scan of each profile, and unless it's a clear no, I swipe right or yes. If they match with me, I take a proper look and decide if I want to message them, copying and pasting the same opening line to everyone. "Hi, how's it going? What's been the highlight of your past week?" Half of them will not reply. Of those who do, half will send some sort of response that rules them out. Such as, "Hi, cutie. 1, you haven't answered my question. 2, you haven't asked me anything in return. And 3, don't call me cutie." When someone manages to give a half-decent response, after a few more messages, I'll ask them out for coffee, thus wading through the masses with minimum effort and maximum efficiency. Sexy, I know. But my strategy has generated a ton of dates. From the economist to the poet to the sailor, one thing I love about dating is the chance to meet new people and hear a bit of their story. I have had my fair share of unfortunate experiences, though, from the guy who was so nervous he spilt his coffee all over me, to the guy with a fetish that I wish to this day I did not know existed. Nevertheless, there have been some real gems too. The first was Simon. He ticked all my boxes. Outdoorsy, spiritual, and passionate about social justice. We dated for a couple of months, which was big for me. But whilst I willed myself to, I just wasn't feeling it. And I learned that dating isn't about ticking boxes. So, it was back to the apps. I'd heard about a new Christian one, but a quick scroll through and I was fairly sure most of the men on there would run a mile from my liberal theology. And me theirs. Usefully though, when you've made your way through your daily batch of potential holy suitors, this app provides you with videos to help you on your Christian dating journey on topics such as how cuddling leads to sin. I couldn't get any of the men on there to chat to me. Maybe I looked like I might cuddle them. Slightly disillusioned with the apps, I asked my friends if they knew anyone to set me up with. One sprang into action, telling me about a colleague of hers and arranging a walk in Crawfordsburn. On the day, the car park was absolutely packed. And as a spatially challenged driver, I managed to find myself literally millimetres away from scraping my rusty wee Kia against a very flashy looking Audi, much to the dismay of the driver inside, who of course turned out to be him. Like our cars, we were complete opposites. And yet he soon turned into boyfriend number one. And a great first boyfriend he was. Thoughtful, funny, kind and handsome. When things ended, I was confident in my decision, but also very grateful for our time together. So, it was back to the apps, where I met boyfriend number two. He had just moved here from South Africa, having been approached on LinkedIn with a job offer in the UK. Dreaming of a London adventure, he accepted, only to find out a few months later that he'd actually be moving from Cape Town to Toom in County Antrim. Naturally, my first question was, are you okay? Again, boyfriend number two was kind, thoughtful, and another important step in my journey. Alongside the apps, I challenged myself to take the good old-fashioned approach of asking people out. Well, maybe not so old-fashioned for a woman, but you know what I mean. I started with a childhood friend who I'd always had a wee crush on. We went on a date, and whilst it didn't go anywhere, I was proud that I put myself out there. My next attempt went less smoothly. My flatmate had been trying to set me up with her brother's friend. In the interim, I'd met the guy in question at my church and resolved to go and speak to him. At the end of a service, I clocked him standing at a table by himself, strode up and launched into a nervous monologue before realising that he was actually in the middle of taking communion, munching on the body of Christ and about to move on to the wine. Why I didn't leave at that point, I do not know. Instead, I continued my monologue, the content of which I have little idea of, but which concluded with something along the lines of, "So, if you ever do fancy grabbing a drink, I think you have my number." As I turned to leave, I resisted the urge to say, "The blood of Christ to keep you in eternal life." I kind of wish I had, though. Anyway, it was back to the apps, which I was unfortunately discovering the darker side of. I had two particularly negative experiences in a row. In both cases, their charm almost led me to excuse the inexcusable. Thankfully, I didn't and came away unscathed, but a bit shaken. I needed a date with a kind guy to restore my confidence and found just the one, a smiley, sweet, sciencey type. I arranged to meet him for coffee. The day beforehand, I was chatting to a friend about my two recent experiences. She was commiserating and shared a similar story, showing me a photo of the guy, just in case I came across him. It was my smiley coffee date. I messaged him explaining I'd had a couple of negative experiences recently and had decided to take a break, apologising for cancelling the day before and wishing him all the best. "You're full of shit," came his response. You went cold on me a few days ago, his angry messages continued, concluding with, you're a C-U-N-T. I hate that word. The tears started to flow. Because of how scary it is that someone can seem so sweet and yet be so quick to flip. Because this was three guys in a row. Because of the risk you're taking as a woman every time you meet a guy from an app. I learnt there's a tricky balance to strike between being alert to the dangers whilst also remaining open to the chance of a healthy, meaningful connection. Thankfully, boyfriend number three was an example of the latter. When we matched, I spotted a friend in one of his photos and sent her a screenshot asking, who's your pal and is he nice? That's not my pal, that's my brother, came her response. He was my most recent relationship and the one for which I am most grateful. My wonderful friend Rach, who you met at the beginning of this tale, had passed away a couple of months earlier. It seems just right that in a story about love, she was the first person you met, as my love for my bestie is one of the deepest I have known. Even though he never knew her and was just getting to know me, boyfriend number three walked with me through my grief. In my tears and middle-of-the-night existential crises, he set the bar for the empathy, love, and patience that I'm looking for. And my time with him was an example of how significant a relationship can be, even if it doesn't turn out to be a life partner. So that brings us to the present. And it's funny, one of the most important things I've learned over the past 6 years of dating is that I don't need to be in a relationship. That it's not a failure to be single. That my singleness is a choice. A choice despite the sometimes crushing societal pressures, not to settle until I find the depth of connection that I'm looking for. And who knows if I'll find it, if I'll succeed in my search for love. But whatever happens, I'm proud, and I know Rach is too. Proud that I'll be able to look back and know that while I may have started later than most, once I did, I sure as hell gave it my all.
Oh, thanks so much, Kerry. Fair play to you. And what a great story. Come back soon. Now, 10 by 9 is always free and for very good reason. Firstly, I love free stuff. Secondly, no one should ever feel they can't afford to come to 10 by 9. And thirdly, no one should feel their story isn't worth the admission fee. That would put off the very people 10 by 9 seeks to attract. So, that's why it's free. And a big thank you to everyone who has donated either at Patreon, link and website, or at the live events. We are truly grateful. By the way, if anyone would like to sponsor 10 by 9 or you know a business that might, please get in touch at the website. Here's our third story on this podcast, and it features a rite of passage no one does better than the Irish. Barney Gribben can explain.
My mother passed away 2 weeks ago, and this is a story of the final days of her life. She had been doing poorly for a long time and we knew this day was coming, but it was still sad when it happened. And this is a story of some of the humorous things that happened in those final days. Mommy went into a care home 7.5 years ago with dementia. At that time, we thought she would pass away within a few months. She lasted 7.5 years. She was very funny at that time. She came out with a lot of things that only somebody with dementia would have got away with. My brother came in to visit one time with his wife and he says to Mommy, this is my wife. And Mommy looked at her. She looked back at him and says, I wouldn't go around the town shouting that if I was you. At the beginning of February, Mommy went into the hospital with an infection. When the infection cleared up, she picked up pneumonia. And when the pneumonia cleared up, her health had deteriorated so much that the hospital decided to keep her in for a couple of days for observation. We had a family meeting and we decided that we need to start planning for a funeral. All the different aspects of a wake and a funeral were identified and the jobs were allocated to different members of the family. When the day comes, we're ready to act. The very next day, we got a phone call from the hospital. Mommy's health had deteriorated so much overnight that they don't think she's going to last the day. She must have heard we were having a meeting behind her back. The family landed into the hospital and as the evening was drawing in, we figured that there was no point in everybody staying here. We set up a rota. There was eight of us and we took a 3-hour shift each. That way, there would be somebody with Mummy at all times. She's been taking off food and water at this stage, so this could last a few days at most. Mummy didn't pass away on the 12th, and on the 13th, I was thinking to myself, it's her birthday on Valentine's Day. She's maybe holding on to see her 92nd birthday, and then she'll pass away on the 15th. But the 15th came and went, and Mummy was still with us. The 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th. This is a week without food and water. It's unbelievable. I looked it up on Google. How long can you live without water? It said 3 days. I think she's teaching us a lesson for going and organising a funeral behind her back. Another full week passed of three-hour shifts in the hospital. There was a suggestion put forward that we would all throw £10 into a kitty. Whoever's on duty when Mummy passes away will win the money. I thought it was a great idea. And then we thought, God, no, if that ever gets out, that sounds awful. So we didn't do it. And by the way, I would have won the money. I'm still hurting from it. There was two members of the family had booked a holiday to Las Vegas, and they were to fly out on the 12th of March. Mummy has to have the funeral and 2 days of a wake. So the latest she can pass, she has to pass away before the 9th of March. It's now the 28th of February, and they're starting to get nervous. The doctor at the hospital told us that sometimes a patient would be holding on for maybe a final goodbye, the last words for some member in the family. Tell everybody the next time they're in to say their final goodbyes. I would love to know what the two was going to Vegas had said. Mommy, please die before the 9th. God, don't make us cancel our holiday. But on the morning of the 7th of March, we got that WhatsApp family group call, the one you don't want to answer. I was late joining the call, and the first thing I heard was Mark saying, is this the call? And Brady said, yes, this is the call. Mark left the group call and made his way into the hospital. Mommy has finally passed away. Now, for some reason, nobody could hear me on the group call, but I could hear them. And then I heard Robert saying, did they put a time on it? I thought that's an unusual question. What do you mean putting a time on it? So I waited until everybody had left the call, and I phoned Brady and says to Brady, sorry, I know what's coming next. Brady, you said this is the call. Has Mommy passed away? And she said, no, but her vitals are very low and she'll pass in the next few hours. So Mark hadn't heard this bit. He's away to the hospital thinking Mommy has passed away. He walks into the room and he says, oh God, Mommy finally got away. And he put his hand in her head and Mommy moved her head and he went, Jesus! Now, it's lucky he has a strong heart, or it was his funeral we would have been attending to. Mommy didn't pass away on the 7th, and she stayed with us for another 4 days. The holiday to Las Vegas had to be cancelled. Now, the first phone call that the family got to go into the hospital was Monday, the 12th of February at 10 minutes to 3. Mommy passed away on Monday, the 11th of March at 10 minutes to 3, exactly 4 weeks later. That'll teach us to go organising a funeral behind our back. Now it's time to organise 2 days of a wake and a funeral. There's going to be a lot of people coming through the house in the next few days, and there'll be a lot of tears of sadness and laughter. I have two brothers that own a construction company, Mark and Niall. Niall got a phone call from a client. He was in the town, and could he call into the office to have a chat? And Niall says, I'm not in at work today. I'm at my mother's wake at the minute. And he says, God, I'm very sorry to hear that. He says, I heard Mark's mother's not too well either. Niall says, no, she's not a bit well. She passed away too. Really? Both your mothers passed away at the same time? That's unbelievable. Niall says, well, it's not really. He says, we both have the same mother. He had been a client for years and he thought the two boys were cousins. My mother went into the butcher's one time and the butcher gave her a wee knife. He says, here, Mrs. Gribben, take that home with you there and try it. And Mommy took the knife and held it in her hand. She says, no, that doesn't sit right in my hand. I wouldn't use that. Take it with you, Mrs. Gribben. Go on, give it a try. I think you'll like it. She says, look, there's no point. And she set it back on the counter. So the butcher was packing up the meat, and without saying anything, he slipped the knife into the bag. Mommy went into the shop next door, and when she went into the bag to get her purse, she saw the knife. So she made her way back to the butcher's. There was a crowd of people in the butcher's, and when she walked through the door, the butcher says, Mrs. Gribben, you never paid for that knife. So he took the knife off her. Now, Mommy would have been regular in the butcher's at that time, but 2 months later, she came home with the shopping, and the knife was in the bottom of the bag. Without saying anything, the next time she was in the shop, she hid the knife in one of the shelves. A month later, she came home with the shopping, the knife was in the bag. And for years, this knife passed between the two of them. None of them ever said anything about it, but the knife kept passing. The butcher arrived at the wake, and he was standing at the coffin, and my two sisters were standing at the coffin, and he looked at them, and he says, "Girls, I think I win." He took the knife out of his pocket, and he slipped it into the coffin. There were some tears of laughter at that one, and if Mommy would have been looking down, she would have thought it was fantastic. Mommy was your stereotypical Irish mother. She reared a big family. She was great at cooking, great at baking. She loved the crack, and she was always interested in what was going on in everybody's life. She had a great way of making every member of the family thinking they were the special one. But I knew I was. Even to the end, she didn't pass away until March, so I would have a story for 10 by 9. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Barney. What a wonderful, loving tribute to your mum, and condolences to all the family. And I explained to Barney that normally I would urge someone to allow more time after a loss before telling a bereavement story, but when I read it, it felt like being at the wake, and that this was just an extension of that. Not everyone can do it, but Barney is an original. And that's it for this podcast. Check out all the upcoming dates on our website, 10by9.com. There are some extra events in there. And be sure to keep up with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, where I'll keep you up to date with any news. Thanks, as always, to everyone who makes 10by9 happen. Margaret, Leanne, and DJ Chris, who are irreplaceable. The wonderful team at the Black Box, who are amazing. The audience, who are so supportive and warm. And, of course, all our storytellers. But the biggest thanks this week goes to Richard O'Leary, Kerry Logan, and Barney Gruben. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.